I'll try to keep this really brief. I've been asked to introduce Mr. Dunbar, so this will only take a minute. I'd like to ask everyone a favor for the Dunbars. Since everybody knows them, and they might not remember everybody right away, they're going to have to look at your name cards sometimes. So just as a kind of a gesture of courtesy, when you approach all your friends whose faces you know well, first glance at their name card, and then say hello to your dear friends. That way we'll have everybody doing it, and nobody will know who really remembers each other's name. Okay. So, this is kind of fun. This is, I'm not sure where this comes from. It came from the internet. Somebody said it was Wikipedia. Somebody said it was Baha'i International News Service. It's a summary of Mr. Dunbar's life, and I just want to read this real quick. Mr. Hooper Dunbar served in Haifa from 1973 when he was called to the Baha'i World Center as a member of the International Teaching Center until his retirement in March 2010. He was first elected to the House of Justice in 1988 and then elected to successive terms. That is so accurate and doesn't tell the story at all. Which is, you know, typical of official releases, and that's why I get to talk today, because I really want to tell a story if I can really quickly. And I have to tell you, one of the frustrations growing up as a Baha'i is that we didn't have any sense of context for how new the faith was and how fresh these institutions were and how much everything was changing before our eyes and how experimental everything was. We thought there had always been auxiliary board members, there had always been counselors, the House of Justice had always been there, and these things, the feast had always been a little boring. You know, this is just the way it was, right? So what I'd like to do really quickly, if you really want to get the best out of the Dunbars, you have to understand what generation they came from, what motivated them, and what the center of their life's love is. And so I want to back up a little bit and kind of tell a little backstory. It's a little unconventional, but I'd like to start the story from Shiraz in 1844. Okay? And it's not really a joke. There's two pivotal kind of events that defined the generation that the Dunbars grew up in, or really they served their beginning Baha'i life in, which was the 10-year crusade period. And of course, the initial period I'm referring to is the day in Shiraz when the Bab had his 16 letters of the living. Tahereh couldn't make it, and Mulalia Bastami was already getting pummeled outside of Shiraz. He had the other 16 gathered there, and he gave them a mission, a specific mission. Now, they had been coming and listening to the Bab every day, every day. They were students of the Bab's faith. They had been studying under Sheikh Ahmed and Sayyid Kazem's school. They were deeply knowledgeable. They were in love with the Bab. They would do anything for the Bab. Yet this day was important because this was the day when they became the Dawnbreakers. They went from being students and apostles to having a mission. Okay, and the Bab gave them very specific instructions, and he sent them out to all corners of Persia. And because of this mission, and because of their passion, they in 2 years' time, they effectively spread the message across Persia, and did what the Guardian described as creating a wave of passionate inquiry across the entire country. Now, their mission was essentially the spiritual conquest of Persia. Now, this is very important. This is a very important event because it's a parallel to what happened later. Okay? And what happened later, if you fast forward, I'm gonna skip the Siachal and the Declaration of Baha'u'llah and all that kind of stuff and skip right to 1916, about 70 years later, when Abdu'l-Bahá begins to pen the Tablets of the Divine Plan. Now, it's a set of 14 tablets. They were sent, the first five came across before the war, and the remaining nine came after the war. And those tablets, this charter for teaching, together with Abdu'l-Bahá's will and testament, the two charters that kind of define everything thereafter, those events created something in the Western world initially, and then the entire world. The Baha'is, who had been so carefully nurtured, suddenly had a mission. Okay? And it's a mission we still share today, and it's what defined the idea of being the spiritual descendants of the Dawnbreakers. Okay? So now let's move forward a little bit, because when Shoghi, these are in the last years of Abdu'l-Bahá's life. He passes away a few years later. The Baha'is are grappling with what to do with such a weighty load between the order that was chartered by the will and testament of Abdu'l-Bahá and the mission to spiritually conquer the planet, which was given in the tablets of the divine plan. Very few Baha'is had any idea what to do, actually. It was very overwhelming. And the Guardian actually held in abeyance the execution of this weighty plan for about 20 years, while he prepared the communities and laid the groundwork, using the will and testament to lay the groundwork for the execution of the divine plan. Now, it's in 1937 when the Guardian finally opens the first epoch of the divine plan with the seven-year plan. And this is the beginning. This is when the Guardian was 40 years old. And in the words of Rihikanam, she says, he stepped out like a general leading the army of light. And this was the beginning of the battle period of Shoghi Effendi's life. And coincidentally, 1937 is the year Mr. Dunbar was born. So that's where he comes into the story. All right? And so as we move forward, the Guardian, before launching the seven-year plan, He spent tremendous effort. In 1932, he gave us the Dawnbreakers, and he retranslated these core books with the core ideas that the Baha'is would need in order to be effective in this great crusade he was leading us towards. And he laid out all these smaller plans around the world. They all culminated together in 1953 with one grand 10-year world crusade to bring the Baha'i faith to every corner of the planet. Now, this is where we're at. When in 1956, Mr. Dunbar becomes a Baha'i at the age of 19, okay? He becomes a Baha'i in the middle of this crusade in which, by this point, the Baha'is have been almost raised up from infancy by Shoghi Effendi. He has shown them powers and potentialities and capacities in themselves they never dreamed that they had, okay? And at this point, the love and devotion for the Guardian was such that people dreamed about the Guardian, people had visions of the Guardian, people would do anything to please the Guardian. Okay, it's hard for my generation to understand and imagine how loyal and dedicated the Baha'is were to Shoghi Effendi at that time, and how he really was the general that was leading them in this battle to bring the forces of light to the world. So in 1957. The year after Mr. Dunbar became a Baha'i, when Shoghi Effendi passed away, it's very difficult for my generation to understand the grief and the sorrow and the pain that swept across the Baha'i world. But I do know the result. The result was that any remaining attachment that the Baha'i communities had to their prior lives and homes was decimated, and a huge wave of Baha'is got up, and as a final act of love and devotion to the Guardian, the year after he died, they pioneered all across the world and really started winning the victories of the 10-year crusade. And this, in the year 1958, which is where we're at in this chronology, was the year Mr. Dunbar, at the age of 21, abandoned his very successful Hollywood acting career and flew off to Nicaragua, having no idea what he was going to do, only knowing that he was going pioneering and he was going to do what Shoghi Effendi willed. So this is the backstory. It's the devotion, the love of Shoghi Effendi, the enthusiasm and excitement of the 10-year crusade that was the childhood in the faith of Mr. Dunbar, and I think defined that generation of Baha'is in their devotion to the faith and their willingness to act first, to get out there and put their faith into action. Now, the rest of the story is equally interesting. I'll try to speed it up a little bit. I know that it's been a long evening, but Mr. Dunbar was in South America for the next 15 years. He did a lot of traveling in the villages with the Indians on the Mosquito Coast in Nicaragua. Somewhere in the middle of his five-year period in Nicaragua, the National Spiritual Assembly of Nicaragua was formed, and he was on the first National Spiritual Assembly there. In 1963, now this is his fifth year pioneering, In 1963, he traveled with the National Spiritual Assembly of Nicaragua to Haifa for the first election of the election of the first Universal House of Justice. Again, the message doesn't mention that it was the first Universal House of Justice, which is really neat because the first election of the first House of Justice was done in the Master's house. You can't imagine it having room, but apparently Rehiakonom had the doors taken off all the rooms and it was opened up, and all of the National Assembly members crowded into this historical room to cast the votes for this historic vote for the historic formation of this historic body. And of course, I'm from Alaska, so I have to say, the Alaskans went first. It was alphabetical. So Don Anderson was supposed to be the first person to cast a vote for the first Universal House of Justice. Unfortunately, he did this thing Baha'is do, you know, when they get up and there's a crowd, they say, oh, well, please, please, right? So Howard Brown slipped past him, and forever will Howard Brown be remembered as Elbows Brown? Yes. And this is very recent, okay? So Mr. Dunbar had already been traveling on behalf of the hands at the time, had already, during the time of the hands, they'd been having Mr. Dunbar travel. Because he was working so closely with the indigenous peoples in Nicaragua, he then was traveling through Canada and the U.S., meeting with the tribes and meeting with indigenous peoples in North America. And in 1963, after the election of the House of Justice, the hands then asked Mr. Dunbar and Marilyn also, then they were married by then, if they would be willing to settle in Bolivia, where there was a desperate need. And, of course, they had been at an extreme hardship position, so they readily assented. And I'm not sure of the – I still am trying to piece the details together. But Mr. Dunbar was then asked – Mahmoud Khamsi was the – sorry – Masoud was the auxiliary board member for protection in the area, and he had to return to Iran because he'd run out of money. He was supporting himself, so he returned to earn more money. In the meantime, there was no auxiliary board member for protection for the five countries there, and so Mr. Dunbar found himself being sent around. And he was already running around doing things when he found out later that he'd been appointed an auxiliary board member. You have to have him tell you this story. It's much better when he tells a story, I promise. So that opens another chapter. At the time, this is when there were very few auxiliary board members. There were 9 auxiliary board members for the hemisphere. Wasn't that how they organized it then? And so this is a very small group with tremendous responsibilities. And he was, I believe, 27 years old at the time, 26 years old? Okay, he won't correct me. He was very young. And I guess some of the hands at the time had asked, don't we have anybody a little bit older that can do this job? So they asked the same about my introduction tonight, so it's all right. So he had these tremendous responsibilities to deal with covenant breakers and to do covenant protection issues from the very beginning. And I guess the hands were fairly pleased with him because 5 years later, he was appointed to the first round of counselors. When they created the Institution of the International Counselors, he was one of the initial friends who were selected for that body. So this is, again, the message says he was a counselor. It doesn't mention he was on the first contingent, that he was the first round. This is a new institution. And it's not the last time, because 5 years later, in 1973, by the way, while he's traveling in Iran, he was visiting the holy places in Iran in 1973, when he received word from the World Center that he'd been invited to come and live in the World Center and be a founding member. There were 3 counselors that were chosen for this new institution, the International Teaching Center. So he got this news that he'd be moving to Haifa, and that was, I believe he was 37 years old now. I guess 30, I figured last time that 37 worked in pretty well. He was born in 37. He was 37 when he moved to Haifa, and he lived there for 37 years. So it was a great year. And he served in Haifa from, that would be, someone help me out here. 1973 until 1988, when he was elected to the Universal House of Justice. And then in 2010, he retired from the Universal House of Justice and began his fledgling art career. And that's the chronology. And I want to just add another quick layer, which is why I'm actually giving this introduction today, is that sometime around 1979, he began giving a series of classes at the World Center for the Youth. And I asked him once why he didn't start the classes a little bit earlier, because that's 6 years or so. And his answer was, well, Marilyn and I, we were the youth. What are we going to do, start a class for the Hands of the Cause? Right? So when some youth started coming to the World Center, he began giving these private classes in which he would share with them just the gifts that he had gleaned from his study of the, especially of the writings of Shoghi Effendi. And this class grew over the years. It grew to dozens and then hundreds. And over the course of until 2010, someone tallied it up, and there was like 6,500 youth who had gone through his classes at the World Center. It's a stunning number. And I can tell you from my experience, that class was the most important, the most pivotal experience of my life. And the reason was that Mr. Dunbar has a way of teaching in which he gets out of the way. He loves studying the writings and studying the writings of Shoghi Effendi, and he feels empowered by it. And he shares that with you in a way that you personally do it yourself, and you feel empowered by it also. It's, to him, it's a spiritual adventure. It's an inner adventure that he loves and loves to share. And that's such a non-threatening approach that the youth cling on to that very quickly, and they love Mr. Dunbar. And a little bit too much sometimes. In fact, in 1988, which is where I come into the picture, the year Mr. Dunbar was elected to the House of Justice, I was a little kid who just arrived at the World Center, and I found an environment in which all the youth were deeply studying the writings. They were discussing the station of the guardianship, the dispensation of Baha'u'llah, and it was all this rhythm, this heartbeat was all with Mr. Dunbar's classes. Okay? And he had spread this love of the study amongst these youth, and he likes to tell the youth that give 6 months to the study of Shoghi Effendi, and you will never see anything the same afterwards. Okay, and so I that's really what we're going to be doing this weekend. We're going to be giving 6 hours to the study of Shoghi Effendi, and it's going to be fantastic. I should let you go, but I have to tell you, in 88, when Mr. Dunbar was elected, the youth in Haifa are so possessive of Mr. Dunbar that when his name was called, the youth who were seated way up in the auditorium jumped out of their seats and applauded, and that was not appropriate. But they had this kind of personal connection, so forgive them. Rihi Khanum stood up with this glare like, that is not appropriate. But, youth have never been, well-known for being appropriate, so be it. So anyway, I just wanted to say that it's a great pleasure of mine to be here and to have the opportunity to introduce Mr. Dunbar, because so many of us have been touched by his generous sharing of his own personal adventure in the study of the Baha'i writings. And he does it in a way that doesn't feel the slightest bit scholarly or academic. It really makes you want to take part in it. And I think that's a great gift. And I have lots of other stories, but I encourage you to take advantage of Mr. Dunbar when he doesn't look too tired. Grab him and have him tell stories. He has so many wonderful stories. I mean, Marilyn does too. Ask Marilyn about her mother's exploits in teaching in Honduras. Okay, it's amazing. So this is a real gift. And I just as an example, I in my life got a chance to shake hands with William Sears once. Okay, my little brother will never have that opportunity. The distance. I live on the edge of the generation that was the last to see the Hands of the Cause living. Okay? Mr. Dunbar is the last human alive to have attended a conclave of the Hands. Okay? Our own ignorance of the significance of these events is the only thing that limits us from taking advantage of this weekend and asking really good questions. So I encourage you all to dredge up the good questions, corner him. I might not be giving this introduction next time. Thank you very much, and Mr. Hooper Dunbar. Thank you, John.
You know, when you go to the movies, they show these coming attractions, and all everything about what's going to happen in the movie is exaggerated. And and then you go to see the movie, and you say, wow, well, that was so different, you know. So having you been told how I will give this weekend and how much you're going to enjoy it and everything, I hope you'll all be patient. The second thing is I remember William Sears himself one day was with him in a group of people in Central America, and he said, you know, that these Baha'i conferences are especially good for developing your eyesight. He said, because, you know, you come up and you meet somebody who, you know that from the way they speak to you, you know them, and you can't look at the card. So you have to look at them in the eyes, and at the same time, you have to try to perceive what their name is on the card. He said, the other best thing you can do is, he says, take out a pencil and drop it, and you go down, and as you come up, you read the card. You know, oh, so nice to see you, Sarah. So we're involved in that this weekend, too. Well, I'm sure our eyesight will all be improved. Now, how you do all of this years and years of what was described by Chad in 6 hours, I don't know, but we're going to try. And it's just a taste. It's really like a taste of the honey of the faith, so to speak, to draw close to Shoghi Effendi and to the vision that he infused into his writings. As some of you may have been aware already, or as you might have become aware in the book on the forces of our time, there's so many references to the energies and to the forces and to the dynamic character of the revelation itself, that when you start combining them together, associating them in your mind, you begin to see patterns of things that are so important. You have this burst of creative spirit in the heroic age of the faith, which Shoghi Effendi said, then during the formative age of the faith, was a dynamic element that gradually crystallized in the consciousness of the Baha'is and in the world into the institutions of the administrative order, those institutions serve as channels for a greater outpouring of the potentialities infused into the world by the Bab and Baha'u'llah. So this is just an overview of what we're going to do this weekend, is examine this a bit and hopefully pique your own or renew your own interest in going back and looking at the revelation and the writings of Shoghi Effendi from this particular point of view. And it's one that's very encouraging. I found it so encouraging that I used to give this course over and over again. And I hope that you will also enjoy the same benefits from approaching these words of Shoghi Effendi. We're going to have some breakout sessions that deal directly with the quotations, some of the key quotations, the root quotations, if you will, of the whole understanding of what's going on here. And so we'll have an alternating sometimes. What is it? Let deeds, not words, be your adornment. I always have to ask forgiveness after a weekend like this of talking too much, you know, and doing too little. But in any case, we'll try our best with you, and we look forward to see you again in the morning. It's getting rather late now, past the hour for this meeting. And sleep well and have great dreams, and we'll see you in the morning.